A note from me, the author. The people and incidents in this audiobook are real. I have made every effort to present them as accurately as personal records, notes, letters, emails, memories, and published documents permit. In some cases, I have changed names and details for the sake of anonymity, or combined dialogues to facilitate the flow of the narrative, but only where this does not threaten the book's integrity. Whenever I discuss historical events, I am guided by an obligation to provide as accurate a record as possible, sometimes augmenting a speaker's words with source materials. However, this does not include altering or verifying details behind personal stories. When individuals describe their roles in hijacking a commercial airliner, invading a country to assassinate its president, bribing heads of state, profiteering from natural disasters, seducing and extorting democratically elected officials, and conducting other clandestine activities, I feel that I forfeit my rights to interpret their observations. I do want to emphasize that every major event I participated in has been documented by other authors, historians, and journalists, or within the archives of organizations like the World Bank. The story may be mine, but the episodes are a matter of record.
Part 1. Asia. Chapter 1. Mystery Woman of Jakarta. I was ready to rape and pillage when I headed to Asia in 1971. At 26, I felt cheated by life. I wanted to take revenge. I am certain in retrospect that rage earned me my job. Hours of psychological testing by the National Security Agency, NSA, identified me as a potential economic hitman. The nation's most clandestine spy organization concluded that I was a man whose passions could be channeled to help fulfill its mission of expanding the empire. I was hired by Chaz T. Maine, also known as just Maine, an international consulting firm that did the corporatocracy's dirty work, as an ideal candidate for plundering the Third World. Although the causes for my rage are detailed in Confessions of an Economic Hitman, they can be summarized in a few sentences. The son of a poor prep school teacher, I grew up surrounded by wealthy boys. I was both terrified and mesmerized by women and therefore shunned by them. I attended a college I hated because it was what my mother and father wanted. In my first defiant act, I dropped out, landed a job I loved as a copy boy in a big city newspaper, and then, tail between my legs, returned to college in order to avoid the draft. I married too young because it was what the one girl who finally accepted me demanded. I spent 3 years in the Amazon and Andes as an impoverished Peace Corps volunteer, once again forced to evade the draft. I consider myself a true and loyal American. This, too, contributed to my rage. My ancestors fought in the Revolution and most other U.S. wars. My family was predominantly conservative Republican. Having cut my literary teeth on Paine and Jefferson, I thought a conservative was someone who believed in the founding ideals of our country, in justice and equality for all. I was angered by the betrayal of these ideals in Vietnam, and by the oil company Washington collusion that I saw destroying the Amazon and enslaving its people. Why did I choose to become an EHM? To compromise my ideals? Looking back, I can say that the job promised to fulfill many of my fantasies. It offered money, power, and beautiful women, as well as first-class travel to exotic lands. I was told, of course, that I would be called upon to do nothing illegal. In fact, if I did my job well, I would be lauded, invited to lecture at Ivy League schools, and wined and dined by royalty. In my heart, I knew that this journey was fraught with peril. I was gambling with my soul. But I thought I would prove the exception. When I headed for Asia, I figured I would reap the benefits for a few years, and then expose the system and become a hero. I have to admit, too, that I had developed a fascination for pirates and adventure at an early age. But I had lived the opposite type of life, always doing what was expected of me. Other than quitting college for a semester, I was the ideal son. Now, it was time to rape and pillage. Indonesia would be my first victim. The Earth's largest archipelago, Indonesia consists of more than 17,000 islands stretching from Southeast Asia to Australia. 300 different ethnic groups speak more than 250 distinct languages. It is populated with more Muslims than any other nation. By the close of the 1960s, we knew that it was awash in oil. President John F. Kennedy had established Asia as the bulwark of anti-communist empire builders when he supported a 1963 coup against South Vietnam's Ngo Dinh Diem. Diem was subsequently assassinated, and many people believe the CIA gave that order. After all, the CIA had orchestrated coups against Mossadegh of Iran, Qasim of Iraq, Arbenz of Venezuela, and Lumumba of the Congo. Diem's downfall led directly to the buildup of U.S. military forces in Southeast Asia and, ultimately, the Vietnam War. Events did not transpire the way Kennedy had planned. Long after the U.S. president's own assassination, the war turned catastrophic for the United States. In 1969, President Richard M. Nixon initiated a series of troop withdrawals. His administration adopted a more clandestine strategy, focused on preventing a domino effect of one country after another falling under communist rule. Indonesia became the key. One of the principal factors was Indonesia's president, Haji Muhammad Suharto. He had earned a reputation as a stalwart anti-communist and a man who did not hesitate to use extreme brutality in executing his policies. As head of the army in 1965, he had crushed a communist-instigated coup. The subsequent bloodbath claimed the lives of 300,000 to 500,000 people, one of the worst politically engineered mass murders of the century, reminiscent of those of Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, and Mao Zedong. Another estimated 1 million people were thrown into jails and prison camps. Then, in the aftermath of the killings and arrests, Suharto took over as president in 1968. When I arrived in Indonesia in 1971, the goal of U.S. foreign policy was clear: stop communism and support the president. We expected Suharto to serve Washington in a manner like that of the Shah of Iran. The two men were similar: greedy, vain, and ruthless. In addition to coveting its oil, we wanted Indonesia to set an example for the rest of Asia, as well as for the entire Muslim world. My company, Maine, was charged with developing integrated electrical systems that would enable Suharto and his cronies to industrialize and become even richer, and would also ensure long-term American dominance. My job was to create the economic studies necessary to obtain financing from the World Bank, Asian Development Bank, and U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. Soon after my arrival in Jakarta, the Maine team met at the elegant restaurant on the top floor of the Hotel Intercontinental Indonesia. Charlie Illingworth, our project manager, summarized our mission. "We are here to accomplish nothing short of saving this country from the clutches of communism." He then added, "We all know how dependent our own country is on oil. Indonesia can be a powerful ally to us in that regard. So, as you develop this master plan, please do everything you can to make sure that the oil industry and all the others that serve it, ports, pipelines, construction companies, get whatever they are likely to need in the way of electricity for the entire duration of this 25-year plan." Most government offices in Jakarta in those days opened early, around 7 a.m., and shut their doors at about 2 p.m. Their employees broke for coffee, tea, and snacks. However, lunch was postponed until the closing hour. I made a habit of rushing back to the hotel, changing into my bathing suit, heading for the pool, and ordering a tuna fish sandwich and cold bintang baru, a local beer. Although I dragged along a briefcase stuffed with official papers I'd collected during my meetings, it was a subterfuge. I was there to work on my tan and ogle the beautiful young bikini-clad women, mostly American wives of oil workers, who spent their weekdays in remote locations, or executives with offices in Jakarta. It did not take long for me to become enamored with a woman who appeared to be about my age and of mixed Asian-American heritage. In addition to her stunning physique, she seemed unusually friendly. In fact, sometimes the way she stood, stretched, smiled at me while ordering food in English, and dove into the pool appeared flirtatious. I found myself quickly turning away. I knew I must be blushing. I cursed my puritanical parents. Every day around 4 o'clock, approximately an hour and a half after my arrival, she was joined by a man who I was certain was Japanese. He arrived dressed in a business suit, which was unusual in a country where formal attire generally consisted of slacks and a well-pressed shirt, often made from local batik cloth. They chatted for a few moments and then departed together. Although I searched for them in the hotel bars and restaurants, I never saw them together or alone anywhere except at the pool. One afternoon as I rode the elevator to the ground floor, I steeled myself. I would approach her, talk with her. I told myself there was nothing to lose. I knew she was married to the Japanese man, and I just wanted to speak with someone in English. How could she possibly object? Once I made that commitment, I felt jubilant. I strolled toward the pool with a buoyant sense of anticipation, humming a favorite song. But as soon as I arrived, I stopped in my tracks, dismayed and confused. She was not in her usual place. I searched frantically around, but there was no sign of her anywhere. I dropped my briefcase next to a lounge chair and rushed into the surrounding gardens. I had never explored them before and now found that they were vast, bursting with orchids of every conceivable color, a profusion of birds of paradise and bromeliads that dwarfed those I had seen in the Amazon. But all I could think about was my missed opportunity to admire them with her. Palms and exotic bushes formed little nooks and hideaways. I thought I spied her lying on a towel in the grass on the other side of a hedge. I raced around it and managed to wake up a woman. She clutched her loose bikini top to her breasts, sat up, glared at me menacingly, her eyes accusing me of voyeurism, and shouted in a language I did not understand. I apologized as best I could and returned to the spot where I had left my briefcase. When the waiter approached to take my order, I pointed at the vacant chair where she usually sat. He bowed, smiled, and picked up my briefcase to move it there for me. "No, no, T-Doc," I said, still pointing. "The woman. Where is she?" I figured that it was part of a pool waiter's job to know the habits of regular clients. I suspected the Japanese executive was a good tipper. "No, no," he repeated. "T-Doc. Do you know where she went?" I threw my hands out at my sides and shrugged in what I thought was a universal gesture. He mimicked my movements, smiled idiotically, and parroted back my words. "Where she went?" "Yes. Where?" "Yes," he repeated. "Where?" He shrugged again, his expression aping Alice in Wonderland's Cheshire Cat. Then he snapped his fingers. "Yes," he laughed. I held my breath, relieved that my theory about pool waiters was about to be confirmed. "Tuna fish sandwich and bintang baru," he stated. Deflated, I only managed to nod. He trotted off. 4 o'clock came and went. There was no sign of either her or the man who had always joined her. I trudged off to my room, showered, dressed, and headed out. I had to get away from this hotel. I would immerse myself in the local scene. Chapter 2. Pirating Lepers. It was a typical Jakarta evening, hot and sticky. Heavy clouds hung over the city, threatening rain. I had never left the hotel before except in my private chauffeured jeep. As soon as I stepped off the curb of the hotel's sweeping driveway, I was nearly run down by a three-wheeled bicycle cab known as a bechak. I had passed hundreds while being driven to various meetings, and had always found the rainbow-colored murals painted on the box-like sides of the high seats picturesque, quaint reminders that Indonesia was a land of artists. Now I saw another aspect. These drivers were impoverished men in rags, desperately competing for customers. They rushed at me, ringing bells and shouting to get my attention. In an attempt to avoid being run over, I nearly stepped into a gutter that was black as tar. littered with garbage and reeking of urine. The gutter drained down a steep incline to one of the many canals built by the Dutch during the colonial era. Now stagnant, its surface was covered with a green and putrid-looking scum. The stench that arose from it was nearly intolerable. It seemed preposterous that the inventive people who had turned the sea into farmland had attempted to recreate Amsterdam amid this tropical heat. The canal, like the gutter that fed it, overflowed with debris. I could even distinguish the two by their distinctive stenches. The gutter had an immediacy about its odor, rotting fruit and urine, while the canal carried a darker, longer-term pungency, the mixture of human excrement and decay. I continued along, dodging the bicycle cabs that hugged the sides of the road. Beyond them, in the mainstream of the thoroughfare, was a frenzy of automobile and motorbike traffic, the sound of honking horns, backfiring engines, and muffler-deprived cars was overwhelming, as was the acrid stench of oil on hot pavement and gas fumes in the humid air. The weight of all this began to impact me physically. I stopped for a moment, feeling assaulted and defeated. I was tempted to give up and return to the serenity of my hotel. Then I reminded myself that I had endured the Amazon jungle and had lived in mud shacks with peasants in the Andes who survived on a daily ration of a potato and a handful of legumes and, when asked to name their children, would include the dead as well as the living, the former often outnumbering the latter. I thought about the other members of my team and about all the traveling Americans who intentionally avoid seeing the countries they visit the way the majority of the people living there see them. I was suddenly struck by the realization that my experiences as a Peace Corps volunteer, the bonds I had forged with some of those people, the way they had opened their lives to me, shared their meager provisions so selflessly, welcomed, warmed, nurtured, and even loved me, had profoundly impacted me. Standing alone in the descending Jakarta night, I had to wonder whether I was really cut out to be a pirate. How could I rape and pillage the Bechak drivers, the young men and women who served me at the hotel and in the offices I frequented, the peasants toiling in their rice paddies, the fishermen, seamstresses, shopkeepers, and carpenters? It was one thing to be a Robin Hood stealing from the rich, or a pirate attacking Spanish galleons laden with the king's gold, and quite another to loot the poor. Yet, that was exactly what I was being called upon to do. I would rob from the poor and give to the rich, and in the process, receive my commission. How could I do it? How could Charlie Illingworth and everyone else with related jobs live with themselves? In that moment, I had to accept my personal responsibility, had to acknowledge the possibility that my years in Ecuador had given me a perspective unlike that of the others who did my type of work, or the citizens whose taxes supported us. I had been blessed, or cursed, with insights shared by few Americans. Everyone found ways to rationalize. Charlie fought the communists. Others were simply profiteering. A dog-eat-dog world, they said. My family comes first. Some wrote off other races or classes as inherently inferior or lazy, deserving whatever misfortunes befell them. A few, I supposed, actually believed that investing fortunes into electrical grids would solve the world's problems. But me, what was my justification? I was a young man who suddenly felt very old. I stared down at that canal. I wished I had a copy of Tom Paine's Common Sense so I could hurl it into those rank waters. My eyes were drawn to something I had not spotted before. A large and battered cardboard box slumped like a collapsed beggar's hat near the edge of the stagnant water. As I stared, it shuddered, reminding me of a fatally injured animal. Figuring I was delusional, that the heat, fumes, and noise had gotten the better of me, I decided to resume walking. But before I turned, I caught a glimpse of an arm protruding from around the side of the box, or rather, what appeared to have once been an arm, now reduced to a bloody stump. The shaking intensified. The bloody stump moved along the edge of the box to a corner at the top. It shot straight up. A nest of black hair followed it, appearing like Medusa's snakes above the box, knotted and mangled with mud. The head shook itself and a body began to emerge up until now hidden by the box, a body that sent waves of revulsion through me. bent and emaciated, the body of what I took to be a woman crept along the ground to the edge of the canal. It struck me that I was seeing something I had heard about all my life but never encountered before. This woman, if that in fact was her gender, was a leper, a human being whose flesh was decaying right before my eyes. At the canal's edge, the bodies sat down, or more accurately, collapsed into a pile of rags. The arm I had not seen before reached out and dipped a tattered cloth into the fetid canal water, shook it slowly, and wrapped it around the bloody stump, which had several open wounds where fingers should have been. I heard a groan and realized that the sound came from me. My legs wobbled. I had an urge to race back to the hotel, but I forced myself to remain at that spot. I had to bear witness to this person's agony. I knew in my heart that any other action was futile. This woman's struggle was probably repeated several times a day by her alone. I wondered how many other abandoned souls were performing such doomed rituals here in Jakarta, throughout Indonesia, in India and Africa. A movement caught my eye, another twitching of the cardboard walls. The leper turned slowly to stare at the box. Her face was a blur of red pustules. It lacked lips. I followed the sunken eyes. A baby's head came into view beside the box. I wanted not to watch, but was fascinated, like a man witnessing a murder he is powerless to stop. The baby crawled toward the woman. It sat down beside the leper and began to cry. I could not hear the sound, either because the voice was too weak or the traffic too loud, but I could see the open mouth and the spasms of the little body. The leper suddenly looked up and spied me watching her. Our eyes met. She spit onto the ground, rose to her feet, shook her bloody stump at me, caught the baby up in her arms, and scurrying faster than I imagined possible, disappeared back inside the box. As I stared at the spot where the woman had been, something bumped my back. Instinctively, I whirled and reached for the wallet in my hip pocket. I was relieved to find it was still there and relieved also by the distraction. Two attractive young women sauntered by. They giggled and smiled at me. One wore tight jeans, the other a revealing miniskirt, spiked heels and halter tops. They stopped.
"No picky pockets,"
the one in the mini said. "We love us." She crooked her finger.
"Come,
love us." I shook my head.
"Oh, he like boys," she said.
They turned away. Up ahead of them, a pedestrian bridge crossed over the frantic traffic. They strolled toward it, two tigresses on the prowl, flaunting the sexuality of their swaying hips. The one in the mini turned, grinned, and waved at me. Then they headed up the steps of the bridge. I glanced at the cardboard box. It did not move. A little breeze came up, sending ripples across the canal. I was half tempted to clamber down and hand that woman all the cash in my wallet, but then I spotted her tattered cloth lying on the ground where she apparently had dropped it in her haste to get away from me. I thought it best to allow her the dignity of her privacy. I hurried toward the pedestrian bridge, having no idea where it might take me. The sun sets quickly and brilliantly along the equator, but on this day the heavy clouds created a deception, letting the light linger until suddenly, by the time I reached the bridge, it was nearly dark. On the other side, a neon sign flashed "restaurant" in English. I climbed the stairs. A tall woman leaned against the railing. In the failing light it was difficult to be certain, but she looked beautiful. When I came abreast of her, she said in a shockingly husky voice,
"I your good time man. We fucky fucky."
She pointed at her Adam's apple, made it bob, then her ass, and gave me a smile. Now I saw the layers of makeup. I hurried on. Several streetlights suddenly flickered to life at intervals along the bridge. They sputtered irregularly and cast an eerie yellow glow that gave the place a hazy, almost swampy look. I stopped beside one of them, thinking that my job of forecasting electricity demand must involve researching such things. The cement pillar was cracked, flaking, and dappled with mold. I avoided touching it. I walked on, staring down at my feet in the pockmarked floor of the bridge.
Rusty bits of rebar protruded from the concrete, like angry maggots in the swampy yellow light. I tried to think about the bridge, its age, the men who had built it, and yet I was distracted. An image of that beautiful woman at the hotel pool had crept into my mind. In a way, it was a welcome relief from the reality surrounding me, but it also haunted me. I could not erase her from my mind. The idea that I had fallen in love and been abandoned swept through me. I assured myself that this was absolute foolishness. I glanced up in time to see that I had nearly reached the steps at the other end of the bridge. The restaurant sign was immediately in front of me, attached to the roof of a low complex of buildings on a street set back from the main highway. Below, in smaller letters, it read, "Fine Chinese Meals." A black sedan, similar to ones at the U.S. Embassy, slowly approached the restaurant. The lone vehicle seemed out of place amidst the city hustle.